Conceptually, we've looked at building that infrastructure. Now what we want to do is make the applications available to our users. And so this is the essence of part two. Just the warning again, remember what we look at may well change, but the basic principles are not going to change, but the actual detail. And it's very interesting because I can be doing a demo one day, and I do a demo the next day. I think, oh, that's a new button. You know, what's that for? It's that sort of behavior. Okay, so let's go. SaaS apps. The idea is that we've got all of these SaaS apps, and what we want to have is single sign-on to them. So how are we actually going to implement that? Because what we don't want to happen is everyone having using the same password. We would like one really solid password, maybe not a password at all, maybe logging into Azure AD with Microsoft Hello. And having done that, the next challenge is, what do we do if someone joins or leaves? Okay, so solution is that we can assign applications to a user, and we can select a lot of applications from the gallery. It's a gallery of apps that we can use, or we can add custom applications as well. And how do we authenticate? We can use Federation. If the application will support Federation, we can use a password vault if it won't. So what will happen is when we go to the app, what it will do is it will unlock a password vault for the logged in Azure user and then take the username and password required to gain access to the app. So it'll be a single sign-on experience there. Or there may be an existing SSO in existence. So you may have already got a federated situation, and what we're just doing is integrating into the Azure AD space. So password vaulting is where credentials are securely stored in Azure AD. They could be managed by the user, so you can manage your own credentials, or they could be managed by an administrator. So the administrator could set the credentials. The other nice thing about it is you can actually assign credentials to a group, right? So imagine you've got a Twitter, corporate Twitter account, and you want a number of users to use it. What you can do is you can put the credentials on a group, add someone to that group, which will allocate them to the app, but also give them the correct credentials. However, it's supported through a web browser extension. So beware that those credentials are going to be pushed into the browser. And therefore, a savvy user will be able to find those credentials. Because what you could do is you could just put Stan Fiddler up in front of it and then intercept the credentials going out. So, but you know, it's just a convenient way of working rather than a secure way of actually preventing users from seeing the credentials. You can also do automatic rollover as well, as possible. If you want to add an application, we go to the application gallery, and we've got two ways of adding apps. We can choose one out of the gallery itself, or we can add an app that we are going to, it's our own application. Or the middle option there is configure Azure AD application proxy, which is where we publish an application out through. Once we've assigned the application to the user, they can go into the My Access panel and actually access that app. You can turn on self-service for applications. So a user will be able to look at the Add App within the My Access panel and say, oh yeah, I'd like to use that app. And if you want, you can have an approval workflow. So what will happen is an email will go off to the approver or approvers, right? And then once your access to the app has been approved, you will get an email back to say so. So we can do that as well. How do we get to the access panel? It's myapps.microsoft.com. And when you log in with your credentials, you get to your particular panel. In terms of application configuration, there's lots of now application-specific help. So if we were sort of integrating maybe with Google Apps, right, there are things we need to do in Google to make that work. Okay. However, Google, we can actually use APIs. to make the changes. So we give the credentials for our Google account to Azure AD. It's almost sort of three clicks and you're done, right? So we can do various ways of setting up this, including automatic user provisioning. That requires SCIM, which is System for Cross-Domain Identity Management, and it has to be supported by the app, right? There's not a huge number of apps that support SCIM. But if they do, and let's just step back a little bit, right? We've got our on-prem users, right? But for those on-prem users to be able to successfully log into Azure AD, we need to put them up there, don't we? So we use Azure AD Connect for doing that. If those users want to gain access to a SaaS app, we might need to automatically, or we might need to provision the user into the SaaS app, because the SaaS app may need to build a profile for that user, et cetera. What SCIM will do is automatically, if you assign the app to a user, it will automatically provision the user into the SaaS app, okay? And follow it through from its logical thing, HR database on-premise, sign the app in the HR database, goes into AD, replicates up to Azure AD, SCIM comes into play, and assigns the user automatically to the application. So you can have a complete workflow. And then if you take the user out, right, then they can automatically be deprovisioned as well. Okay, not, as I say, not a huge number of apps support SCIM, but those that do, we can work with. And then the user can be assigned to the app directly via group membership or via self-service. So that's another way of doing it. And in terms of authentication, we could be using an Azure AD identity. We could use an existing SSO solution, or we could use the Password Vault. So again, you've got those three options to give you the SSO capability. If you want to assign access via groups, there's lots of groups that you can use. You can use an Azure AD group. You can use an on-premise AD group, which has been replicated up. You can use dedicated groups. Dedicated groups, knock the S off, because although there are dedicated groups, there is only one of them at the moment, which is all users, right? There may be others in the future, but at the moment, it's just all users. Dynamic groups are very, very powerful. What dynamic groups do is allow you to create a rule which defines the group membership. So you could say, you know, if Office Paris and, you know, job title sales, then add them to a particular group. So we can dynamically add them. And you can also support Office 365 groups, and then we can have administrator-managed or self-service-managed groups as well. So a lot of configuration capability around groups. So if we look at adding an application from the gallery, what we're going to do is actually come in and go across to the portal again, and so back into the portal itself, and we're going to be looking here for enterprise applications. So if we go to the enterprise applications, and I'm going to add one. Okay, just let that enumerate. Okay, so, 2,812 applications ready to go, all right? And what does that mean? It just means that you've got a simplified way of deploying them to your users, okay? So what we got is application you're developing, right, where you're gonna have to do all the configuration. You've got an on-premise application where we publish it out through the proxy, or a non-gallery application. So this is for integrating other apps that you don't specifically find in the gallery. So this might be some other SaaS app that's out there. It's not currently in the gallery, and this gives you a way of configuring to work with it. Okay, so what I'm gonna choose is I'm gonna choose Google Apps just to show you. Let's select that. And then we're gonna add Google Apps. And there used to be a little online tutorial for working out how we configured the apps. What we've got now is actually we've got everything here available to us. So how do we assign a user for testing? Well, we can automatically do it for us. Create your test user in Google Apps, configure single sign-on, set up conditional access, and so on. So all the help is there, plus shortcuts for actually doing the processes as well to make life really easy. But what we'll do is we'll actually go across to have a look at LinkedIn, which I've already got set up. And let's go back here, choose all applications. And there's LinkedIn. I added it from the gallery and then I assigned it to certain users. So let's go and have a look at that experience. So having got that, we'll just close that down and I'm going to go to Access Panel. Remember previously we went as David. I'm going to go as Tor this time. So Tor at 5.users, sign in. And then I'm going to go to LinkedIn. And what it's going to do, it's going to open up the password vault for Tor, pull his LinkedIn credentials, inject them, and automatically gone into LinkedIn. If you saw quickly, actually they're my credentials for LinkedIn, but good example. Now, let's go back to the Access Panel, and we've signed into Azure, so off to the Claims app, single sign-on. So no problem there. We can go to let's go to the OIDC app, and that's an anonymous page. We get Hybrid Flow. We're automatically signed in there. So we've got a, once we've logged in once, everything that is allocated through the My Apps panel is a single sign-on experience. Okay, if you want to publish your own apps, then what you need to do is create yourself an application template. And the application template is defined through the UI, but it's also defined through a manifest file. And the manifest file gives you more capability over what's available in the UI. So for instance, if you wanted to add groups to your token, you'd have to do it through the manifest. If you wanted to add roles to the token, it would be done through the manifest. If you want to set certain permissions, it's done through the manifest. It creates a template, and the reason it creates a template is so that we can work with multi-tenant apps, and I will come back on that. The very, very first time this application gets used, a service principle is created in the Azure AD. And that service principle, once it's instantiated, it holds all sorts of information. It also, you remember when we have consent? So you consent to allowing an application to go to a back-end system, that consent framework, or the permissions granted through consent, are actually held on the service principle. So we're defining an application. What we have to do is define a name, the sign-in URL, okay, a logo, and you think, hang on a minute, why do I need to define a sign-in or sign-on URL and a logo? The reason being, of course, is it goes in the My Apps panel. All right, so when you click on it, you would like a nice logo to go with your app, but also you need to know where to send the user, which is the sign-on URL. Okay, so that's the reason those are up there. You need a client ID, which is effectively an application identifier. You'll need a secret, all right? And whether you need a secret depends on whether you're configuring a native app or a web app, and there's lots of subtleties around that, and it's to do with the OAuth 2 capabilities of this thing. An app ID URI, which is the unique identifier, a reply URL. So you hit the app, you go up here to Azure AD, and what it will do is it wants to reply to a particular URL. Now you can make the request. You can say, please reply to this URL. When you go up to Azure AD, what it's going to do, it will only reply to the URL you've specified if that URL is configured in Azure AD. If it wasn't like that, you could spoof someone to go to a rogue website, which looks just like the real one. They arrive there, you send them off to Azure AD to authenticate, and the token comes back to the rogue website because it allows the return URL. But with this, if you request a return URL to the rogue website, it will reject it, so you will not be able to log in. So there's the return URL, it's really important to us. or the reply URL. Whether this thing's multi-tenant, don't worry about what that is at the moment, we'll come back to it. Whether you want to add groups to the claims, etc. Now, that's the basic application definition. And then what we have is we have permissions for delegated access to back-end web APIs. And you might have one web API you go to, or you might have five APIs you go to. And what you'll need to do is set up what delegated permissions can be asked for to go to these back-end web APIs. And then you've got application permissions. So now, if this app went using its own credentials, all right, what are the permissions to back-end web services? So it can use its own identity to go there. And then, if you were designing an app that had its own web APIs, you'd need to define what those permissions are. So it's quite a complex application definition that you can come up with. So in its simplest form, it would be something like that. So here's an application, and you say it needs to call these back-end web APIs. But if it needed to call them with the identity of the app, you would have to add that component. And then, if you were saying this application exposes web APIs, you want to say what permissions are available. So you define those. Consent from the user will be required for delegated access. And in the UI, there is a button which the admin can click on to grant consent. And if you've ever used consent previously, this button appeared probably about 4 weeks ago. Previously, if you configured an application template as an administrator, consent was assumed. It says, you're an administrator asking to go to these back-end resources. We'll say, you've got consent. They changed that model, so as an admin, you don't automatically have consent unless you click on this button, which says grant permissions, which is a new button. And when you come to set up the consent, you've got the...
that button there.
Sorry?
It's that button there, the
it's
grant.
It's this one here, grant permissions, and it doesn't explain what it's for.
I know, I was going to ask you afterwards what that was.
I didn't have a clue. So you've come across it recently.
So if you change the permissions of the application, you have to press that afterwards.
If you want to give permissions, so you want to give consent for everyone, you press that button.
Right.
But if the moment dynamic consent is not supported, so if you change the permissions, what you need to do is destroy the service principal. So if you this guy holds all the permissions in a linked list,
yeah,
you destroy it. Right, the first time the application is used, everyone will be asked for the new consent, for the new permissions.
Right.
Unless you click on the grant permissions button, in which case it's automatically granted.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, in terms of asking consent, it asks you something like that. You know, it says, do you consent to sign you in and whatever it says, I can't... Oh, there you go. Sign you in and read your profile. Do you consent? Trouble is, nobody reads these things. They just accept it. If you want to block users giving consent, you can do so, right? Use a bit of PowerShell, and you can actually stop them giving consent. So the only person that consent to access is the administrator. And then there are certain permissions which are considered too sensitive for a user to consent to. And you have to be a full-blown administrator to do it. So here, calling principal cannot consent due to lack of permissions. You need to be an administrator to give that consent. Nice. So if we look at just have a brief look at this and look at defining permissions, what we've got is we can come in to our application itself. So we go up here, which one are we using? Let's go to the OIDC application. So it's application registrations. And we're going to OIDC Azure 2. And here we've got required permissions. These are the permissions it requires to back-end systems. At the moment, we've only got one web API we're calling. And what we've got is application permissions, which are the permissions that the application, using the application context, right, so that's the identity and the secret for the application to a back-end system, or the delegated permissions. And notice that it says requires admin consent, read, you know, hidden memberships, yes, you know, read and write groups, you will need to use admin consent to get those. Okay. So we'll leave that as it is, and let's go and look at the experience of that. So let's go and close that off, and I'm going to go to my OIDC Azure 2 app, Hybrid Flow, and I'm going to go in as James. And we need to, once we log James in, he's going to be prompted to accept this. So what's he accepting? Well, you know, what does James do? He just clicks accept. Because people don't read these things at all. I mean, it's a bit like dialogue box, or, you know, the message box is okay, cancel. What do you do? You click okay. But what it's saying is the OIDC Azure 2, which is the name of the application, needs permission to sign you in and read your profile. Oh, yeah, okay. I think we could accept that. And that's it. So now he's consented. And what we're going to do is go back in again. And we go to Hybrid Flow, going as James again. And this time, he will not be prompted for consent. Okay. So how do we get rid of consent? Well, we go to the Access panel. And this is getting rid of consent for an individual user. We can click on here. Get the information, that's the consent you've given, and we can go remove. And what all that will do is remove the object and the consent that goes with it. Now, if we go back again, what we do is be prompted for consent. As an alternative to a user giving consent, we can use sign in the hybrid flow and admin consent. So here, an administrator is calling an endpoint to actually give consent for everyone to the application. So if we look at that, what we see this time is says, if you agree, this application will have access to the specified resources for all users in your organization. So this is a global admin consent. So once you consent here, everybody's got access. And so I can accept that. And then this time, if we log in as James again, he's not going to be prompted for consent. So we go in as hybrid flow. An alternative to doing that would have actually been to click on the grant permissions button. So that would have done it for you. But that just gives you a little bit of an idea of how consent works. Now, with James, once he gave his own consent, he could remove it. Right. Once global consent is given, the only way of removing it is to blow away the service principle. And then once you've done that, then you can redo it. Okay, if you want to publish an application to the internet, then there's always a challenge around DMZs. Obviously, hardware cost, maintaining security. I always like to assume that when you first set up your DMZ, you hopefully get your security right, right? But before you know it, you know, you've had deployed something into a DMZ that requires this port open, then you take that one out and you deploy something else and needs that. You end up with a Swiss cheese firewall, right? So it can be very expensive maintaining security, but also if you want to authenticate someone at the edge of your network, so you don't want them on the DMZ until they've been authenticated, how do you do that? There are devices that will do it, but you know that's another issue. So maybe you need to spend more money to get a hardware device that will support that. And then if you've got in your DMZ, you've got web resources, how do you authenticate people to those web resources? Right? So some people I've seen deploy read-only domain controllers, you know, into the DMZ, and you've still got to open up a lot of ports to support them. So To get around that challenge, what you can do is you can use the Azure AD application proxy. And it's a service up in the cloud, all right? You don't know how it's implemented, and you're not meant to know how it's implemented. All you know is there's a public URL that's available. So there's a public IP, and you have a URL that you use to get to your application that you've published internally. What happens is you have a connector that comes from the cloud to an on-premise endpoint. So this is a server running the connector. That connector connects outbound to Azure AD. It actually connects up to the service bus. Connector, obviously, if you had just one of them, you'd have a single point of failure. So what they allow you to do is create connector groups. So I could have, you know, three connectors coming into one data center, and it will do load balancing over those three connectors. And if one goes down, it will just use the two that remain. If you've got multiple data centers, so I publish an application, and it's in this data center, I can have a connector group to this data center. Let's say use this connector group. Let's call it connector group A. I can have a connector group to this data center, connector group B, and a connector group to this data center, connector group C. So I can actually set up multiple connector groups to manage across multiple data centers. Prereqs, you need Azure AD Basic or you need Premium, and that could be P1 or P2. Remember, P2 just has P1, you know, plus identity and PIM. And the connector's got to be installed on server 2012 R2 or higher. You can install it on Windows 8 or higher, but why you'd want to do it, I have no idea. But it's in the spec, so I put it in. I suppose if you were doing some testing, I still actually don't know why you'd want to do it. But anyway, it's there. The on-premise firewall has to be enabled for outbound connections to the connector. There is a list in the... if you look online, you'll find a list of outbound ports. There's also, when you install this thing, there's a troubleshooter. And at the end of the install, the troubleshooter is going to check that the outbound ports are actually available, right? And if they're not, it will tell you which outbound ports are blocked. So what you do is go onto Azure, you download the connector, you start the install. What it will do is ask you for credentials for your Azure AD. You put them into the connector. It finishes the install. The troubleshooter runs, and then it checks that the outbound ports it needs are available to it, among other things. Now, if you've got a claims aware app, what's going to happen is you're going to come to the published URL, and you're going to knock on the door. Please let me in. Right? And if you've got authentication turned on, so you cannot go, you can have pass through, in which case the proxy will just pass you straight through to the application. On the other hand, if you say authenticate with Azure AD, what's going to happen is the proxy up in the cloud is going to say you're not authenticated, right? And it's going to send you up to Azure AD. You're going to log into Azure AD, and you're going to come back down to the proxy. Okay, at this point, it's going to say, okay, you've been authenticated. I'm going to allow you through. And what I'm going to give you is something, so when you come back again, you'll still get through. And what does it give you? A cookie, yes. All right, so you've now got a cookie, which is an edge access cookie to get you through. But you come now, you're coming through the proxy. You're coming all the way down through the connector to the on-premise. At that point, you're going to connect to the internal URL of the application. And now the internal application is going to have to do authentication. Nothing has been passed down. So the fact you logged in as John to Azure AD is not passed down to the internal application. It's down to the internal application to do the authentication. So if we look at that, if we have an app that trusts Azure AD, so claims-based app, what's going to happen is we're going to knock on the front door, up to Azure AD, authenticate with Azure AD, come down, get an edge access cookie, come through to the application. The application is going to look at me and say, you're not authenticated, so where's it going to send you? If it trusts as your AD, where's the app going to send you? It's an obvious answer.
Zero AD.
A zero AD, yes. Up you go to a zero AD. What happens now? It says, you're going to say, please authenticate me for the app. But what have you already got?
You've got the
cookies. Cookies. You pass them through, bam, you're automatically authenticated, single sign-on. Right, so you log in to a zero AD, now you've got single sign-on all the way through. Okay. There are lots of different ways of cutting this and making it work. If you're interested, I actually I wrote a white paper on very technical detail of this for Microsoft, probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Also on Channel 9, I did a very detailed coverage at Ignite last year. So if you want an hour and 15 minutes worth of the Azure application proxy, have a look at that. If you want to read the white paper, have a look at that. If you can't find it, I put a link on our website. If you go to the resources section, you'll find a link to the white paper there. Windows authentication. Now, you say, well, why do I want Windows authentication? Well, people are really, really keen on publishing legacy apps and getting legacy apps to work in an SSO environment, okay? And this is possibly one of the biggest uses of the application proxy today, or the Azure application proxy. So what happens now is we come knock, knock, knocking on the front door, up we go to a zero AD, back down we come, right? And we go through to the internal connector. And what we've done is we've configured the proxy to say internally, use Windows integrated authentication. So what it does is the endpoint goes to the KDC and says, I've got this user, John at using the UPN, right? And if you've used an alternative, you can still use the original on-premise UPN. I've got this guy, John at xyz.com. Please give me a Kerberos token to the backend web service. And what it will do is give back the token, it gets injected into the header, and now you've got a single sign-on to your internal Windows Auth application. And for this to work, the connector endpoint, this guy here, has got to be running as a domain member for this to actually work. So let's just have a very quick look at that. And what I'm going to do is start off by going to internally to my Windows Auth application, and I'm going to log in. I could pass the credentials through automatically, but when setting up environments, I tend to always disable the browser automatically passing the credentials. The reason being, you've got a checkpoint. You know what's being asked to, you know where you are in the flows. And that's why I always turn it off. But if I'd set this up so this website's on the intranet, right, and allowed credentials to be passed straight through, they would have gone straight through from the browser and I would have had SSO to the app. But it's always a good checkpoint. Notice down here, it says authentication authority asserted identity. Okay, so just remember that one for the moment. So this is me going to the application internally on my corporate network. And it is using Kerberos. And if it's not using Kerberos, don't even attempt to get it working through the connector. It has to be Kerberos internally. Right? It will not work. It's using Kerberos constrained delegation, which means it needs to be able to talk to the internal web service using Kerberos. Okay, next job is we attempt to go through the WA proxy. And the first thing that happens, knock, knock on the proxy front door, and it centers up. But notice it was redirecting us, and it's redirected us down to our corporate STS. So what's happened is we've knocked on the front door, said, log me in as John at 5.AD. He says, you're a federated user. So I'm going to pass you down to your on-prem STS. So we're actually down onto the on-prem STS now. And again, if I was within the corporate network and I had the automatic authentication, I'd automatically authenticate at this point. So I'm just going to go in and authenticate to my STS. and I get single sign-on all the way through. So what's actually happened is we've hit the outside, knock on the door, up to a zero AD. A zero AD is recognized as a federated user. We've been redirected down to our on-premise ADFS server. We've authenticated there. We've now got through the proxy, and we're now down onto the actual, having gone through the proxy, we're down to the application with the KDC injecting the credentials. Okay, now, I said I would mention this briefly, I said I'd come back to it. A multi-tenanted application. And what a multi-tenanted application is, it was a way that Microsoft came up with of actually allowing multiple tenants to access one application that is actually published in a single tenant. Okay, so you publish an app in your tenant and you mark it as multi-tenanted. And then automatically, anyone from any other tenant can authenticate against your application. So if you only want one other tenant to authenticate against your application, tough, anyone can. So what the application has to do, the application has to decide who it's going to allow in. Right, so it's an application decision. We can't make the decision in a zero AD. What we've done, it said, this is multi-tenant. So any tenant can actually authenticate against it. There has to be consent involved. So if someone wanted to come from B and authenticate against your application, there would have to be consent given in B to allow it to create tokens that could be consumed by your app. Right. So, but the app is going to have to decide which tenants it will accept tokens from. Normally, your app would say, oh, I've got a token. Is it for me? Yes, it is. It's got the app ID. Is it from an STS I trust? And normally, it would be the same STS the app was published in and say, yeah, I trust it. But now it's going to have to say, it's going to have to make that decision based on the token. And there's no way I can control that within Azure AD. Now, that's changed with the B2B model, which we'll come to in a moment. But before we do that, let's have a look at B2C. The idea of B2C is that we create an Azure AD, which is specifically designed for B2C. And with B2C, we can create sign-up policies. Because with B2C, this is directories is effectively managed by Azure infrastructure itself. So we can automatically have users sign up to use it. We can have sign-in policies. We can have editing policies. We can have other policies as well, so password reset policies. And what the policy does is it controls the user experience. So when you sign up, what can you sign up with? You know, we can decide on the identity providers. So I could sign up with a Google identity or a Facebook identity, or I can sign up with a local identity, in which case I'm going to be created as a user in this Azure B2C directory, and my password will be held in this Azure B2C directory. If I sign up as a Google user, I will be authenticated by Google, right? But I'll still be represented as a user, effectively be an external user in the directory. So associated with this directory, obviously, what do we use it for? We use it for gaining access to an application. So there's an application defined for this B2C directory, or multiple applications. And now we've got these users who can sign up and access the application. And we control what the sign-up experience, the sign-in experience looks like, and also we can have an editing policy which says when we sign up, if they ask for multiple attributes, we can decide which attributes they can edit in the edit profile. And the attributes that are present and claims in the token, we can decide which attributes are added as claims into the token as well. Now, there's a huge amount of work going on B2C. So all I can say is expect changes. Question.
Can you have it by invite only?
Can you have an invite only? Certainly not at the moment. B2C you can do by invite only.
So B2C you can, right? Okay.
Yeah. B2B. Sorry, B2B. I meant to say B2B. Right. I meant to say B2B. You can have invite.
Okay.
Okay. And we'll come to that. We'll come to those invites in a moment. Okay.
So you can do Microsoft Federation. You can do a Microsoft tenant here, an AD. Azure
you cannot today,
yes,
through this UI or the UI that it currently exists, yes, do an Azure AD tenant.
Seems right?
But I just say, watch this space.
Makes it unnecessarily painful.
Yeah, but there is going to be a huge amount of flexibility built into this. And do expect a lot of changes. Actually, yeah, I couldn't mention it, but you can always mention what you mentioned to me earlier.
Well, though, behind it, you can. It is an Azure AD tenant.
Behind it, it is effectively an Azure AD tenant. Yeah. Yes.
So you can't always log in with on Microsoft.com.
No, because you can't. There's very little you can actually do to it. You can do rudimentary things to it, but not a lot. In a sign-up policy, let's say we've defined a policy providing two identity providers. You can sign up with a Google account, you can sign up and define a new account inside the directory. And when you're defining a new account, what you're gonna do is supply a password, you do an email verification, you get verification code, and then you can ask for attributes. So here, I'm just asking for city as an attribute, so you add the attribute. If you were doing it with Google, off you'd go to Google, you'd sign in with Google, and then you'd come down and populate your attributes. Okay, let's do just a very, very quick demo of that in action. So I'm going to go off to a B2C application, and let's start off with a sign up. So I'm going to sign up as a new local user, so user ID, and we'll create a new user. We'll call him Dave. We need a password for Dave. And having got a password in for Dave, what we'll do is we'll get an email verification. What I'm going to do is just give my email address for the verification. So it goes in there. And then we ask for a verification code. And while we're waiting for that, what we'll do is we will set the city. And we'll set the city to London. I'm going to leave the display name for the moment. Okay, so we'll leave the display name unset, verification code. And what have we got? Okay, so that's the verification. We'll verify it. We'll create this thing. And now we're in. And what we don't have is a actual user name here. So we got London in there, but we didn't set a name. So let's go back in again, and we're going to go in now just to log in to prove that it works. So we sign in as Dave. So I need to go use another account here. And of course, a normal user wouldn't see, you know, if you were Dave on your own machine, you wouldn't see other people's account. It's just they're cached in my browser. And there's our name, which is unknown. So let's go to edit the profile. And there's the unknown name. What we'll do is we'll set that to Dave. Continue on there. And there is Dave, and we've got the city as London. Okay, so it just gives you a sort of very brief look at sort of B2C capabilities, but this is sort of very early stages of what B2C is going to be ultimately capable of. Mm. So keep an eye on what Microsoft are up to. Okay, Azure B2B. So with a B2, you remember the multi-tenant the environment. What we did is we published an application that was available to all Azure AD tenants. So anyone from any tenant could authenticate to our application. So then it was down to the application to decide whether you were going to allow that tenant in or not. Okay, which is not the greatest way of doing things because it puts more responsibility on the application, and what we'd like is responsibility in the directory, in terms of the management of the directory. So here, what happens with B2C is we have John in another directory. So John is in the B directory, and what we'd like is John to be able to access our application defined in the A directory. So we send off an invite to John and say, hey, come and access our application. And as part of that process, we will create an external user that represents John. Okay? John will get an invite, and he redeems his invite. Right? And once he's redeemed his invite, he will now be able to come to our application. He comes to our application, and it will say, ah, you're John, you're an external user. Right? And what it's going to do is it's going to send John off to his own tenant to authenticate. So he authenticates with his own tenant, but then he comes back as an authenticated external user, and we say, okay, which apps are you allowed access to? Right? Which groups are you a member of? So now we are in total control in our directory as to his group membership, right, and also the applications that have been assigned to him. So he will have his access panel will be for his own directory, but it will also be for our directory. He'll be able to choose which directory he's working on his access panel. So we'll have a little drop-down list of the directories. So what does this mean? This means if John gets fired from directory B, bang, he can't log in anymore. So he's lost access to our application, all right? If we don't like him anymore, bang, this side, all right? And he can't log in to our application. So we're totally in control through the management of the directory of that user. As I say, because we can assign him to applications, his panel will show the appropriate apps. Yes, question.
Is there a synchronization between A and B in terms of John?
So very, very good question. Is there a synchronization between the two? Yeah. No, what you'll have, yes, there's a synchronization between the two in terms of John's identity. So we know where John is. So John is an external user, and what will happen is that we will know when he's logged in over here that he's actually, it matches up with our external user in our directory. However, if you change profile information for John over in the original directory, it will not be synchronized into the new directory.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to say is that if John tried to authenticate the resources on A, does A, the idea goes to B and say, can you authenticate him, or is it?
Yeah. Okay. Just hold on one second, and I think it'll be explained in the next couple of slides. Okay. Traditional federation dance was like this. Okay. So you had your application, which trusted your STS, and then you trusted a partner STS. Okay. So if you like, what would happen is our partner user would browse to our application. Our application would say, you're not authenticated. And our application will only know about our STS, right? So this is our application only knows about A, all right? So it's our STS. Our partner is B. So here, our partner over there is B. So we browse, you're not authenticated. And so what it does, it redirects the STS. The STS is going to do home realm discovery. So our user is going to put in their login name. And it's immediately going to identify that that user, right, belongs to a different directory. Okay, so we're going to send that user over to that directory to log on. Okay. So we're going to authenticate on the, with that directory, and we get a security token that is for consumption by our IDP. Right? Not by the application, it's consumption by our IDP. And what that token will do is identify John from B. Right? So now we can process the token and say, oh yes, John from B, he's this external user, John A. So what groups does he belong to? What apps is he assigned to? And we can make all those decisions at that point. Okay. And then what will happen is we get the token back, which can then be passed through to the application. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you have a profile for John in the other directory and you modify it, that is not synced across. So after the initial relationship is established, there is no synchronization between the two directories.
So once the John B is called fired, because you already got that user in A, so do you have to remove it manually?
Yeah, so if John gets fired from B,
yes,
right, there's no cleanup at the moment in A.
Manually.
So you but it's no big deal because it's just that it's effectively it's an orphaned account, but nobody can use it. Right, so there's no possibility because the only person that can log him in is B. Right, so it's meaningless, that account. And if you created a new John in B, it would be a different John.
So Gilbert, what does it use to synchronize the two? Does it use the, like an SSID rather than a username to manage the two?
In terms of it's all GUID based. So we're using the identities are GUID based, which in theory are unique across everything. Was there a question?
B always has to be another Azure tenant?
There's no okay, B always has to be another Azure tenant. These are great questions because that was a fantastic question because it was a slide that answered it. That's another fantastic question because I have a slide that answers that in a second. All right? We'll get there in 1 second. And any other questions? Yes?
If you're publishing your own SaaS, is this effectively what you do to make it a multi-tenant?
No. There's a very, very distinct difference. If you make it multi-tenant, it means anyone. You will have to. If you create an app, right, which has a URL, just call it URL1 to make life easy, right? You publish that in your own.
No, I mean, if you're publishing it to Azure as one of the apps you can pick.
If it's your own app and you put it in Azure.
Yeah.
You can mark it as being multi-tenant.
Yeah.
In which case, any tenant can authenticate against it.
Okay, so you have to have your own billing mechanism.
So you have to have your own billing mechanism and everything else. So you have a whitelist, right, of tenants that you allow access.
Yeah.
Whereas here, what's happening is, this is, although the relationship is between two tenants, it's actually on a per user basis. So what we've done is we've marked John as an external user. So what will happen is we then log him on in B, and then we come back over here and process his group membership and all the rest of it. Okay, so how do you make that work? That just works, right? What it is, you don't do anything with the app. So it's just a standard published application, right? Whereas with a multi-tenant app, we actually mark it as being multi-tenant.
But you've set up the trust to the other directory, though.
It just happens automatically.
Okay.
All right. So that would be the traditional federation dance. But if you do this mechanism, it just works. So what we have is we have, once we've established the B2B relationship, what will happen is we have this app in A, and we end up sign in. It sends us up to the Azure cloud, right, to do the sign in. We do the home realm discovery. It says, yes, you need to go over to B, right? And what will happen is we'll authenticate the user in B, and then having authenticated the user in B, we'll actually We will then authenticate the user B here. A will, Microsoft don't talk about trust, but it's a good way of illustrating it in terms of the traditional federation. What will happen is now we've authenticated this user here, so it means John as an external user with his group membership and his application assignment is now from here. Okay, and then I think this answers your question. So what you do is you invite someone to come and access an application. So you send them an invitation. In fact, what you do is you define them as a user. And when you specify the user is you put an email address in, right? So what we have is you create a new user. And you can do this using APIs. You can do it using PowerShell as well. We create a new user, and we specify a username, which is an email address. Okay. So what will happen is an email will be sent to that address. Okay, and that address will then look at that address when this guy comes back to redeem. So he's now come back to redeem via this email address. And Azure is going to say, ha-ha, do I have a tenant that matches that email address? Right? And does that user exist in that tenant? And if they do, it effectively establishes this trust. I use the term loosely, trust, but it's we trust them in terms of allowing him to authenticate in that directory. Okay. Having done that, this if that user does not exist in that directory, so let's say the user is Fred at xyz.com, right? And xyz.com exists as a tenant, but Fred does not exist in it, right? It will fail unless you enable email verification on that tenant. All right, so if you enable email verification, then what it will do is it will send Fred an email to verify his existence and add him automatically to that tenant. But email verification by default is turned off. All right, so it will not work by default. So what will happen is that the invite redemption will fail. Because what will happen is you've sent Fred at xyz.com an invite. Fred goes, oh yeah, let's redeem this invite, right? And what it will do is it will report back, you don't exist in that tenant. Okay. So the next situation is where you invite someone and no tenant exists. So let's invite Tom at notenant.com. So Tom at nt.com, okay? And what Microsoft says, aha, no tenant. So what I'll do is I'll make one for nt.com. And it automatically creates a tenant.
Is that like a hidden tenant that you can't manage? Well, it says unmanaged.
Yeah, it's an unmanaged tenant. All right? It's completely unmanaged. You can't manage it in any way whatsoever. Right. So it creates this, it puts the user in that tenant. Now, what it doesn't do is it will not do that for commercial email domains, for obvious reasons. However, the interesting thing is email domains that Microsoft do not recognize as commercial, it will do it for. So it's a matter of interest. I was doing some testing, and I thought, okay, this was a year ago or so. I thought, what email do I have from someone that might not be considered as commercial? I thought, oh, I know. I got a Virgin Media email address. So let's invite myself, all right? And I invited myself, and lo and behold, I was in a tenant. An Azure AD tenant, and I could, access the resources. And then I thought, I know what? I'm a user now in this Microsoft tenant, so I'll use PowerShell. And I accessed this unmanaged tenant using PowerShell. Because I'm an ordinary user, I have read access to the directory, very similar to on-prem AD, right? And guess what? I can enumerated a whole list of users out of the Virgin Media, Virgin Media unmanaged tenant. And yes. So I'm not sure that's a great idea, but that's the way it works.
But what if your B2B relationship, and this is prolific in my organisation, is with freelance editors and writers, they just use Gmail or BT Internet or Virgin Media. So how can I have a B2B relationship with them if I can't use an unmanaged tenant?
If you can't use an unmanaged tenant, and if it's Virgin Media, you can use an unmanaged tenant. But if it's a consumer email domain, they have a fix for that, which I'll come to in a second. Okay. So, but if the user is present in an unmanaged tenant, just trust is established. So if the user's already there, so if they've already done something, and you know they might have joined the party with another Azure AD as a B2B user, in which case they will be in there, trust established. And then if an unmanaged tenant exists for the user's email domain, but the user is not present, the user is added to the unmanaged tenant automatically, which means that email verification is turned on by default on unmanaged tenants. Question.
At what point would that fail when you say you can't use a consumer email? Is that where you try and add them? Is that where you try and create the invite, or when they try and redeem it?
No, this mechanism does not work for consumer email. There is a different mechanism now, all right, which I'll come to on the next slide. But if for instance, this situation here, let's say we invite Tom from xyz.com. xyz.com exists as a tenant, but Tom does not exist in that tenant, right? He can't automatically be added unless email verification is enabled. Yeah. And at the point of redemption is when Tom will find out.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is a redemption time. Because until we redeem it, we don't really know whether these tenants exist or they don't exist. Okay, now, the one with, if we're hitting this one, where we're considered to be coming from a consumer email domain, what it does is you send the invite to the user, they come back, and if it's a marked consumer email domain, it could be Gmail, Yahoo, Hotmail, etc. Okay.
Is there a full list somewhere?
No, I've never managed to get a list. But it would be nice to have a list. I've never managed to find one, but I haven't looked probably in the last 4 months. So one may exist or may not exist now. And in fact, this functionality was only added in beginning of February. Right, so there may be a list published since February, but I've not seen it yet.
Is it guaranteed that people don't come off this list, or was the list just changing constantly, ins and outs?
Pass. I don't know how they maintain the list. Well, obviously they didn't get Virgin Media, did they? So there's a Virgin Media unmanaged tenant at the moment. Okay. So the next thing is, we redeem it, and does a matching Microsoft account exist? So if you log on at john@gmail.com, what it will do is it will look to see if there's a Microsoft account, which is john@gmail.com. All right? If one exists, then what will happen is we will simply get you to sign in with the Microsoft account. All right? And that's what you use. If one doesn't exist, then it effectively creates a Microsoft account which matches the name. So it will create your Microsoft account with the actual account name at john@gmail.com. Right? And then you'll log in using that account. So that's how they deal with the consumer email domains.
That doesn't block the user from eventually using that Microsoft account, I assume.
Sorry?
That doesn't block the user from one day trying to create a Microsoft account and it's already locked away in the system?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, I guess, if it's a matching Microsoft account, but you've got forgotten your credentials, you've got to go through password.
No, like if you edit somebody and then a year later they decided they needed a Microsoft account with that detail, does this somehow switch into a public?
But you'll never, if let's say you have john@gmail.com, yeah. You can have a john@gmail.com Microsoft account, but there won't be any real difference. You can never have emails arrive to that Microsoft account because it's a Gmail email.
But you won't be able to reset, like, will that person be able to reset the password and take over that Microsoft account?
Well, it is that person.
Isn't this the case if the person doesn't already have a Microsoft account?
Yeah, so they'll be forced to create one.
Yeah. You're forced to create one. It creates a matching Microsoft account. It's not automatic. So, and you will need supply credentials for it. Yeah, okay. To make that clearer. So you'd be asked
to create one.
Yes.
And set a password.
Well, you'd be asked if you want to create one and set a password and all the other bits and pieces. I mean, I guess the grief will be if there is one already and you've forgotten the password and you didn't set it up with a phone number and anything else, you might be into a difficulty of recovery situation. But I'm not quite certain how you would deal with that.
Well, if it's got your Gmail email, it will email your
email. Should email your Gmail, yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
You have received an email, so.
Yeah. Well, you've received an email to your Gmail, otherwise you've never got the invite.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. So you're okay.
So that's their solution for dealing with.
John.
That situation there. Yep.
Very good. Am I right to say Hotmail is Microsoft's email, isn't it?
Yes.
And they still got blacklist kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it's what you have to use is you have to use a Microsoft account to sign in with. That's all. Yeah, it's because if someone's inviting you, it will end up being a Microsoft account that signs you in. If you're going down this route. Now, one question you haven't asked, which I'm surprised about.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What I'm trying to get out of it tonight is if I want to federate two AD tenants and take up the functionality of B2C in one solution. Is that possible?
Okay, so you want a B2B relationship.
I want a B2B and the B2C.
And you want to add B2C in. At the moment today, no.
So I have to deliver the app twice.
Yes, effectively. However, once you can establish a relationship where an identity provider could be Azure AD, things may change.
Okay.
All right, but you know, just watch the space to see what comes out.
So I'm a little confused. The normal Azure AD, you can do this with anyway. Are you saying there's a B2B? Is there a B2B version of the AD?
No.
So this is the normal AD.
This is a normal AD. And this unmanaged tenant is a normal AD. Okay. But it's unmanaged.
That's right. Okay.
So there is one definite question you should be asking. What happens if you own, if it creates an unmanaged tenant automatically, what happens if you own NT.com? Right? Well, you can do an internal or an external takeover. So if you do an internal takeover, you can merge the users into another directory, or you can just take the domain over. It then becomes managed, right? And you do that through DNS verification. Okay, so we've done that one, and we're spot on time, which is good. And again, finding out more. Do remember, if you're interested in the. If looking at hands-on in the UK, the masterclass, please just put a note on that the form we left you. If you could feedback on the session, that would be really, really good as well. Watch out for the TechNet blog, and also consulting available on request. And I'm going to put this slide deck up. I will actually put the location of the video up when we've done it. And the best way of announcing that is via Twitter. So if you join the Twitter feed, then you will get that information. And that, in a very short space of time, hopefully is giving me a little bit of insight into Azure AD. And thanks very much for coming along.
Thank you. Thank you.